Welcome back to the Science of Sports Recovery podcast. And a quick note about this episode, before I introduce you to the guest, I want to tell you that there is so much value in this particular episode that it is very important that you share it with somebody. So take a listen, and I don't even care if you don't subscribe or if you don't leave a review or what have you. I just need this message to get out to the masses because it can literally make or break somebody's athletic career. I mean, we talk about what many people get wrong with icing that is literally making them injured longer and not improve. So share this. Okay, now that my rant is over, let's introduce our guest. As you'll quickly learn in this conversation, Gary Reinl is very passionate about the recovery industry, especially when it comes to practices that don't make sense. Gary was one of the first people to really blow the whistle on the RICE protocol and has now worked with over 100 professional teams over the last 20 years to facilitate proper recovery and has had astonishing results with them. Not only has he helped athletes get back to playing quicker, his athletes actually see less strength and speed loss during their recovery period. So how does he do this, you ask? Well, I can tell you this, it's not by icing. He is the author of the book, Iced, The Illusionary Treatment Option, a book, by the way, which is very well written and I highly recommend. But he has spent nearly 40 years in the sports medicine field, and Gary is here to continue to educate on the proper, scientifically proven way to heal from injuries and workouts. So with no further ado, let's get into it.
You're listening to the Science of Sports Recovery podcast. Each week, we explore how to recover more efficiently from training so you can work out harder and realize your full potential. This is the Science of Sports Recovery podcast.
Hey, Gary, it's great to have you on the show.
I love being here, Josh. Thank you very much, Chase.
Awesome. Well, we've already done an introduction on you, and I've read your book. I recommend anybody listening to read your book because you're a wonderful storyteller. There's a lot of stories that are weaving into really practical use of injury, like recovery. But there's two that really stick out to me that I want you to cover. Because I think it gives us a good overview of who Gary is, not necessarily from a intellectual capacity, but more as a person, as a personality. So you've always kind of been a little bullheaded, it seems, or you testing the boundaries from a young age with a combination of your quick mouth and pride getting you to run. 63 miles and one bout in high school. How did that come about?
Oh, I actually love that story. It's one of the first stories in my book. And you're right. It really was a reflection of who I am. A couple of my buddies had ridden their bikes. We lived outside of Philadelphia, and they'd ridden their bikes from where we live to the Jersey Shore, which is a beach area about 60, 70 miles from our house. And they were whining about how hard it was. And it was it took forever. And I walked up and said, I could run it. Well, that was around 8 a.m. in Center Hall. By noon, it had spread through the school that I was going to run from Philadelphia to Ocean City, New Jersey. And now what was I going to do? I had to do it. Could not do it now that I said I could. Of course, I had no idea if I knew how to do it. And by the way, I never even thought about how to do it. That morning, I got up and put on a pair of Converse sneaks and did it.
Yeah.
And I'm often reminded by people that it's quite a feat for a high school junior to run that far back in 1971. I mean, you got to kind of run this through. That there's no such thing then. We ran in Converse sneaks, the flat Converse basketball sneaks. No water, no supplies, no travel car, on our own. We went for hours and hours and hours with no supplies whatsoever. And we did this in June off the side of the major freeway, which was likely approaching 95 to 100 degrees easily off the side of the road. And we know that because we looked back and we looked it up. But I remember how hot it was.
Yeah.
And we had no water. You can't do what we did. And people say, that's amazing that you did that. I said, no, actually, it's not amazing that I did it because I trained. I was running about 4 or 5 hours a day for about a month and a half before I did it. So I, you know, I made the claim I was going to do it. And then I did it, but it was 5 or 6 weeks later that I did it.
Yeah.
And people said, it's amazing. I said, well, no, I actually trained. I was, you know, I was somewhat prepared to do it. But the guy that went with me, Bobby Chipineau, I'm far more impressed at Bobby because Bobby was a 3 varsity letter guy, football, basketball, and baseball.
Yeah.
And I said, Bobby, are you going to train for this? He goes, no, I'm good. You know, I'm in good shape. Bobby never trained and he made it.
Yeah.
So anybody out there who's saying, wow, you know, you did that. Let me tell you, say, wow, Bobby Chipineau did it because he was way more capable of an all-star status than I was because he never trained. He just did it. Now, I admit, and I think he would too, that I drug him a little bit late in the day. You know, those last 20 miles or so, I probably had to, prop him up a couple of times, say, Bobby, come on, we can make it. But still, he did. I mean, think about it. He did not prepare and he did it.
Yeah.
So that's the story of how it happened. And when we came back to Center Hall, after our run, that we did it on a Saturday and we came back to school on Monday, and people were like, I can't believe you did it. Well, actually, it was not proven that we did it, but because we ran it along the side of the highway from Philly to Ocean City, lots of people saw us.
Yeah.
So somebody drove by at, 7:30 a.m. and they saw us.
Yeah.
And then someone came by at 11 o'clock and they saw us. So lots of people saw us running.
Yeah.
And it was also reported on the local radio that we were doing it. One of the guys in our class had called the radio station to tell him, and he gave him progress reports. Now, understand, the only progress report, because there were no cell phones.
Yeah.
The only progress report was when we stopped at what was called a Wawa store. That's like a 7-Eleven type store.
Yeah.
And with a couple quarters in the thing, we called the guy and said, hey, we're halfway. That was the progress. No phones, no supplies, nobody helping us on our own.
Man.
Go do it. So, it actually has messed up nearly my whole life, though, because anything that I do that's hard, I compare it to that day.
Oh, man.
And nothing's been hard ever since.
It's probably a reflection of the time, but as I'm about to be a parent, so I'm starting to think of situations from a parent's view. And I just think of how in the world did your parents let you run 63 miles without doing any sort of giving you water or food or anything like that?
Well, to be honest, I'm not sure my parents realized what we were doing.
Oh.
So I don't recall ever mentioning to them that we were running. I remember saying we were going to the shore tomorrow, but I don't recall ever saying we're running to the shore tomorrow.
Okay, that makes sense.
So we're not going to blame my parents for this. I may have kind of omitted a little of the information when talking to them about it.
So the takeaway I want the listeners to get from this story is we're going to talk about how Gary, basically single-handedly took on the Rice protocol. And it takes somebody that, like Gary, that's going to do it and says he's going to do it and just does it without, really the fear, because there would be a lot of fear taking on something like that. And it clearly, obviously, I'm sure you feel fear, but it doesn't seem to be a factor for you.
Well, to tell you the answer to that, because I think it's important to add to your point there. Mm-hmm. It never crossed my mind we weren't going to be able to do it. Mm-hmm. I had no fear.
Yeah.
I mean, I had no fear. Remember, we were so ignorant of the facts. We had no idea how long it was going to take. Sure. We had no plan of how long it was going to take.
Yeah.
Like, I never said, oh, I'll do it in this many minutes a mile. We'll be there at this time. No. No, our buddy drove us to the bridge and off we went. You know, that was it. We got out of the car and started running. No water, no power blocks,
yeah.
Nothing. And there wasn't fear because of the gross ignorance. Was this dangerous? I never thought it was dangerous. It just seemed like they rode a bike, I'll run it.
You said you were going to do it. You did it. So the second story, I think it would be really impactful, is the story about pull-ups. There was a pull-up school record, and I can tell by your face, there's still some sort of maybe regret or disappointment in this story from you. Why? And tell us, like, why there's that regret, what happened, and what you learned from the experience.
Well, this is a turning point in my life when this happened. Mm-hmm. And I never was bluffed again.
Yeah.
What happened was the school pull-up record was 41 Marine pull-ups. So that's dead hang, straight up, no kipping, no jerking. You actually have to do a real pull-up, chin above the top, eyes looking over top of the bar. So you can't be looking to the ceiling. You got to be looking over the bar. So real pull-ups.
Yeah.
And I was good, but I wasn't great. And it was a long way off the first time I tried. I mean, I didn't do that many the first time, you know, maybe 18 or 20 the first time. And I had gotten to a point where I could do like 27 or 28 or 29 pull-ups. I mean, pretty consistently, I could just hang and do it. So to cement my commitment, I told all the boys. We were standing at where we hung at the high school.
Yeah.
And I said, it was the summertime, school was just about to come back in session. And I said, I'm going to break the pull-up record this year. And they're like, oh, yeah, how many can you do? I said, well, you know, 26, 27, 28, 29, somewhere around there. So one of my buddies said, well, let's see. So we walked back to the chin-up bar, and I did it. And I did as many as I could, and in the upper 20s. And I got down, and they were impressed. You know, that was a lot of chin-ups for a high school kid.
Yeah.
And pull-ups, they were, not chin-ups. And with that, the word got around that I was going after the pull-up record. Well, another guy in the class who was much tougher than me, one of the toughest kids in the class. Mm-hmm. Now, arguably, I was one of the stronger people in the class, but I was very small. So for my weight, I was very strong. But, you know, in reality, I was not, was maybe 140 pounds, 5'7". So, you know, I'm not much of a threat.
Yeah.
But I was strong. And another guy heard about it. He said, well, I'm already doing 40. So, you know, nobody else should even try. I got this locked up.
Yeah.
Well, as it turns out, that wasn't true. And we were both on the Marine Corps National Physical Fitness Championship team. Mm. Our high school went to the Nationals. And the first time I saw him do pull-ups, I had pretty much quit. I stopped trying, because what's the point of practicing when someone else is already at 40 and you're in the upper 20s? There's no way to catch them. Well, to my shock and surprise, the first time he hangs in the bar for the tryouts for the team, he gets like 17 or 16. And I went, what is this? I never saw him get above 20.
Yeah.
By that point, it was too late for me to break the record, although I immediately started training to break it. And I got the 39. So I missed it by 2, tying it, 3, breaking it. There's no doubt if I hadn't given away those 4 or 5 months, I'd have broke it. Mm-hmm. But I got bluffed.
Yeah,
that never happened again.
Yeah. So This is such a powerful story because, and I think this happens more, almost probably almost in everybody's life, where they say, I'm going to start to do something. And then there's somebody, whether they announce it to somebody or they just see somebody that's in front of them with whatever they want to do. And they're like, oh, they've already done it. And then they stop. Whereas there's so much more that you can give, and you don't know where they actually are at. You know, they can say that they're at this level, or they make this much money, or they run this fast, or they can do this many pull-ups, but you don't know until you see it. And you don't know what their motivation is to continue compared to yours is.
Well, mine was a bluff. And when I found that it wasn't true, I, on the spot, committed.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to break it. Well, I didn't break it. I came really close, but I didn't break it. But I never forgot that. Mm-hmm. And when someone said, well, you can't do that, it's too hard. I mean, the conversation we're going to have today about taking on the Rice Protocol and the anti-ICE movement. When I first suggested it to some of the professional team trainers that I deal with, the first guy said to me, Gary, don't do that. And I said, why? He said, you'll ruin your career. He said, don't mess with that. And I went, well, but I know it's wrong. He said, Gary, don't do that. Mm-hmm. Well, we went back to my pull-up days and I went, no, yeah. I'm doing it. And I jokingly said in the early years, I'm old, so it really doesn't matter if I fail. Who cares? No one will care.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go after it. And this time, the pull-up story actually proved to be to my advantage because it's what made me go, nope, you're going, you're doing this. Now go do it. And I did it.
Yeah. Yeah. So if anybody listening, if they can learn from the pull-up story without having to actually do it themselves, learn. So. But this gets us a good segue into the icing conversation. And I read your book and it was very eye-opening to me how sometimes cultural norms just take over as science. And there's an overarching acknowledgement that icing is what you do after you sprain an ankle, you know, bruise, there's swelling, there's whatever you name it, you ice tub after workouts or what have you. That's kind of become a cultural thing, but it's not necessarily the scientific evidence to back it up. But before we get into the science, you outline kind of why it came into our society. How did icing become the cultural norm for healing?
Well, it's not for healing, but I get your point. People think it is.
Yeah.
So what happened was the whole Rice Protocol, which is rest, ice, compression, elevation.
Yeah.
There have been reports, or there are reports, of people using ice for pain control going back many years. Now, the question is, where'd they get the ice from? I mean, you gotta run this through because nobody at Miami had ice 150 years ago. And there are lots of places in the world where there couldn't have been any ice. So if someone did use ice for pain control, I believe it could have happened. And, you know, you kind of figure it out. If you happen to be in the snow and you rolled your ankle and you put ice on it, it made it hurt less. And it doesn't mean it helped, but it made it hurt less. So somewhere along the line, icing damaged tissue was tried. Couldn't have been widespread because there wasn't ice. Mm-hmm. So that's where we start with. But in 1964, 1962, a young boy by the name of Everett Knowles hopped a freight train in Somerville, Massachusetts. And what happened was he cheered for himself in celebration for hopping the freight train. And if you ever lived anywhere where there are freight trains that go through, you know that every 12-year-old boy is going to hop a freight train and ride it for at least 50 feet because you got to.
Yeah.
And when he cheered for himself, he hit a stone abutment. And when he hit it, it ripped his arm right off. And it didn't break it. It ripped it off. And he fell to the ground. And thinking he had broken his arm, he picked his arm up in his jacket, not knowing it wasn't attached. And he got up to a factory up the top of that hill, and some guys helped him and got him over to Mass General Hospital. And the young doctor there by the name of Ronald Moll made an historic decision, changed the history of medicine, actually. He said, we got a perfectly healthy 12-year-old and a fully intact arm. Let's put this thing back on. Well, long time ago. That wasn't expected. Mm-hmm. So they had to go assemble the team to do it. There were no fax machines or cell phones or text. You had to go get the doctor. So you had to get an orthopedic surgeon, you had to get a neurologist. You had to go get the people who could do this to put this arm back on. And with that, the doctor made the decision to change the history of sports medicine. He said, put that arm on ice while we're getting this figured out. Now, why would you put the arm on ice? Well, for the same reason that fish in the fish market are on ice.
Yeah.
Because it slows the rotting, the decaying of the tissue. So it made sense for that purpose to put it on ice. And now they get the team together. They sew the arm back on. And the hand starts to turn pink. And they're like, wow, it worked. That makes worldwide news. Then when the little boy wakes up and waves the first time to the media, it makes worldwide news. And in fact, that doctor, Dr. Ronald Moll, began to travel around the world teaching other doctors what they had done that day to successfully reattach a severed body part.
Yeah.
Ultimately, the question was asked, and we can't find the original question. I tried.
Okay.
But it did happen. A reporter said, Doc, if this happens, what do we do? What do we need to know? And I understand before you just threw the body part away. So you needed to know what to do.
Yeah.
So the answer was remain calm. Don't panic. That became rest. Keep the severed body part out of the heat, out of the sun. Keep it cool if you can. That became ice. Use a tourniquet to prevent a bleed out from the intact part. That became compression. And elevation was simply keeping the body part above the heart to slow down the bleed. So the rest ice compression elevation protocol has utterly, literally nothing to do with managing damaged tissue.
Yeah.
It has to do with preventing a bleed out and preserving severed body parts. And it says that that couldn't happen. Oh no, that's what happened.
Yeah.
And that was in 62. And then by 78, when Dr. Merkin, the man who made up the Rice protocol in his sports medicine book in 1978, he called it rest ice compression elevation. What he did was actually report it on what was happening in the space, out in the public space. Mm-hmm. And I was told recently by a reporter that had talked to him, I've talked to Dr. Merkin multiple times also, been to his home. And Dr. Merkin said that he added the E, the elevation, because Rick didn't have a ring to it. And he added the E. And that's it. That's where it came from.
Yeah.
Now, Dr. Merkin has since acknowledged in his recanting publicly that I made this up in my 1978 sports medicine book. Research has clearly shown I was wrong. Don't do it. It delays healing and gives a specific reference to the fact that it causes additional damage. Mm-hmm. Dr. Merkin not only has publicly recanted since he read my book, he wrote the foreword to the second edition of my book.
Yeah. Yeah, if you didn't catch that, that's like, you could almost stop the conversation here because the guy who says Rice protocol, first Rice protocol, this is what you do to treat injuries, then has now publicly rescinded that and wrote the foreword to essentially the book that says that is totally not the right way to do it.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
That That in itself is an awesome story. But I want to dive into a little bit more about the icing claims and what is actually happening, because there's inevitably somebody listening like, okay, that's a nice story, but I've heard icing does this, and I do icing because of, you know, blank. So I'm going to run down some claims that icing is supposed to do, and we'll just talk about like what is actually happening there.
Okay.
So icing is supposed to stop the bleeding. So internal bleeding or anything like that, it's supposed to reduce or stop the bleeding. What would you say to that?
Well, it's not true. Mm-hmm. The bleeding stops as a result of the process inside the body that is multiple facets, factor one, factor two, factor three, yep, up to the Wilburn factor, and all these things have to happen to produce a clot. Yep. That clot is the result of ingredients that are in the blood that have to get to the damaged site that are signaled to come and transform as a result of any blood leaving the vessel. So as the blood leaves the endothelium, which is the cell-lined vessel,
yep,
as it leaves, a signal is set off that changes everything inside the blood, inside the vessels. And so what happens is, if you make it cold, you actually slow down the clotting process. You don't speed it up, you slow it down.
Mm.
And the fact of that is, it's indisputable. There isn't even a potential to argue it.
Yeah.
How could the repair and cleanup crew get to the damaged site if you slow it down? So it doesn't speed up stopping blood. In fact, there's an article in the journal Hemophilia, two articles actually, where they say, look, we looked this up and we've been telling hemophiliacs, or people who can't clot,
sure,
or have difficulty clotting, that they should ice. But then it actually says in the journal of hemophilia, for heaven's sakes, it says, we've been telling people to do this, but it doesn't work. It's not right. It's wrong. So see, it's just not true.
Yeah.
But you can make up anything you want, and exactly, it makes sense, sort of, because if you slow down the flow, wouldn't that slow down the bleeding?
Yeah.
Yeah. But what about the clotting? How does the clotting take place? Well, the factors, the things in the blood that have to get to the site to grow that clot, you've slowed them down. So mm-hmm, basically what I call this the repair and cleanup crew, you've slowed the repair and cleanup crew. The repair and cleanup crew from getting to the damaged site.
Yeah.
So it's just one of those, oh, that seems to make sense. No, it doesn't.
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense at all. It's wrong.
For sure. Yeah. Well, we're not looking to slow down the blood. We're looking to clot, essentially, to stop the bleeding. That's how your body is designed to stop the bleeding, correct?
Yeah, it's called hemostasis, and you can look it up. You can Google it if you want. Just Google, how does the clotting factor work when you, mm-hmm, when you break a vessel? And there's 100 videos or more online. Every single one will tell you what I just told you. It's the way it works. You can't, the stuff has got to get there. The repair and cleanup crew has got to get to the site to build the clot so the vessel can be repaired. And then remarkably, it prevents the clot from getting too big, because then it would block, you know, you don't want to block the flow.
Yeah.
So it makes the clot just the right size, repairs the vessel in 3 to 10 days or so, and then dissolves the clot, normalizes flow, and you didn't do anything if you stayed out of the way.
Yeah.
Now, if you think you're going to be able to stop bleeding by making it cold, see, you're sort of right. You can, but you haven't solved the problem yet. The hole's still there.
Yeah. Yeah. So that takes care of that one. We'll move on. This one might take a little bit more unpacking, because there's maybe a misconception of what swelling is and what inflammation is. But icing has been told to reduce swelling and inflammation. So what would you say to that?
Two entirely different things.
Yep.
Inflammation is your immune's response to the tissue damage, and you can't heal without inflammation. Ledbetter says in the great article, Loading, in the Journal of the American Orthopedic Association, a great article back in 99, where they explain how the process works. Ledbetter says there can be inflammation without healing, but never healing without inflammation. So inflammation is phase one of three phases of healing. It's inflammation, repair, and remodel. Yep. That's in everybody's textbook. There's no disputing that. So there are some things that people question me on because they don't understand, but that one everybody learned. It's inflammation, repair, remodel. So what is swelling? Well, you want, by the way, you don't want to block inflammation. And the good news is making it cold doesn't block inflammation. It merely slows it down. Yep. When the tissue rewarms, the inflammatory response resumes. Fortunately, because if it didn't, then all the people that had ice would never have gotten better. Yep. So the good news is your immune system remembers what it's supposed to do when the tissue rewarms and the inflammatory response resumes. Swelling, on the other hand, isn't a good or a bad thing. It's merely the accumulation of waste at the end of the inflammatory cycle you have not yet evacuated. That's all it is. So it's not a bad thing. Nothing wrong with it. It's just the accumulation of waste at the end of the inflammatory cycle you have not yet evacuated. So a reasonable question would then be, according to me, well, how does swelling evacuate? Mm-hmm. Well, I don't want it to get there. Well, wait a minute. Are you sure you don't want the fluid to get there? Yeah. Because again, going back to the clinical textbook, the damaged vessels constrict and the surrounding vessels dilate and increase perfusion. So the surrounding healthy vessels dilate and increase perfusion. In other words, the fluid is coming there on purpose. That's your immune system mobilizing the repair and cleanup crew to get to the damaged site to solve the problem. So are you sure you want to stop that from getting there? By the way, making it cold won't stop it. It'll merely delay it. Mm-hmm. When the tissue rewarms, the inflammatory response resumes and the fluid will come.
Yeah.
So let's just say you were right and you should stop it. You want to stop it.
Yep.
I'm going to make it cold and I'm going to stop it. Well, what about when it rewarms? Well, I'm going to stop it for now. Okay, we're going to stop it for now, but when the tissue rewarms, it's going to come anyway, but isn't it supposed to come?
Yeah.
Let's just say that too much is coming. That for some reason, your immune system doesn't know how to regulate the proper amount of fluid repair and cleanup crew to send to the site.
Yeah.
You're so smart, you're going to regulate it. Okay, is it 3% too much, 47% too much, 91% too much?
Yep.
You different than me, hands different than feet. How are you going to regulate it? How will you measure it to know you're there? See, the problem is that people say things like that, but they've never thought through, well, what's the next question?
Yeah.
Well, the next question would have to be, are you sure it shouldn't be there?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it shouldn't be there. Okay, well, how much shouldn't be there? Should you block it all?
Yep.
Should you block 2%, 18%, 21%? How much should you block?
Yeah, I think
there's no way of knowing that. But remember, it's wrong. It's supposed to come anyway.
Yeah. I think from a general public standpoint, they might see like, oh, my ankle is abnormal now. It's swollen. It doesn't look right. So I want to keep it looking right. I think that's where the notion is, not necessarily that that's, obviously the right notion, but I think that's kind of where a block is for some people.
Yeah, no, but see, you're introducing a different question there because you're saying now the swelling is there. You're no longer trying to stop it from getting there.
Sure.
You're noticing it's there and you want it to go away.
Yep.
So you're going to make it cold to make it go away. So you're going to shut off the signals between the muscles and the nerves. And that's going to move waste, the swelling, through a passive lymphatic system. Let's just go check in the textbook and see if that's true, if that's how the passive lymphatic system works.
Yep.
Okay, key word, passive.
Yep.
It is a passive lymphatic system. The waste moves through that passive lymphatic system via muscle activation around the vessels that, in effect, milks the cow backwards. It squeezes it up a chamber. The empty chamber has negative pressure. The negative pressure pulls the swelling, the waste out of the interstitial space, and so on. So you milk the cow backwards. You get how it goes?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Before you get too far down this on the swelling, I want you to explain the lymphatic system. So if somebody's not in like, they're a parent of an athlete, they didn't study this. What is the lymphatic system when you're talking about that?
Okay. So there are two major systems in your circulation, your vascular system. That's your heart pumps, the blood goes out. goes out through the arteries, through the arterioles, and then down to the capillaries, then to the capillaries, back to the venules, back to the veins, and back to your heart, and it circulates.
Yep.
So there's a pump. Your heart's pumping that around.
Yep,
that there's a return system to pick up the excess called your lymphatic system. Okay. It's a one-way system without a pump. There is no heart pumping. And in effect, it's your sewage system. So okay. if you looked at a city and you yep. saw all the things above ground, and then you said, well, where's all the waste go? Well, it's in pipes under the ground. Well, mm-hmm. in effect, these are the pipes under the ground. So your lymphatic system, there's some 165,000 miles or so in your body of lymphatic vessels, and they're everywhere. They're intermediate, they're superficial, they're deep, they're all over your body, they're just yeah. everywhere. And they pick up the waste, the excess fluid,
okay.
and bring it back through your system and then filter it along the way and then kill the bad guys if they catch any.
Got it.
And in effect, it's like your garbage disposal. You know, in your garbage disposal system, when you push the button, it goes vroom, and it yeah. all goes away.
Yep.
Well, that's your lymphatic system. And the button you're pushing is muscle activation.
Okay.
So you've got to activate your muscles around those passive lymphatic vessels, and it squeezes the vessel mm-hmm. and pushes the weight up a chamber. So there are little chambers with return valves so it can't backflow. And so that empty chamber now is a negative pressure that pulls more waste out of the interstitial space. And then you squeeze it again and it pushes it out. So it's okay. it's muscle contraction around the yeah. vessel, push waste up, empty chamber, pulls waste in, push it up. And I say it's like milking a cow backwards.
Yep.
So okay. that's your lymphatic system. And in your body, the lymphatic system, well, you won't survive very long. I mean, within days, if your lymphatic system stops working, it has to be there.
Yeah.
And what's interesting to me, as I learned about the lymphatic system, is how little attention is paid to the lymphatic system by most people who are in the business. Now, things have changed in the past 10 years.
Okay.
The lymphatic system's getting a lot of play now. But 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 yeah. years ago, when I started, 47 years ago, when I started, I never even heard of the lymphatic system.
Yeah.
But I did know something that doctors always check for: swollen glands. I had no idea that was part of your lymphatic system.
Oh.
No one ever mentioned that.
Yeah.
No one ever said, oh, that's what he's checking is your lymphatic system. So, you know, that's the one of the catch points. And it's like, really? Well, why didn't anybody ever say that?
Yeah.
I heard about veins. I heard about blood, but I yeah. never heard about the lymphatic system.
Yeah.
And it turns out the lymphatic system is the only way for that waste around that swollen ankle to evacuate. There's no other way out, by the way. There aren't six paths. There's
yeah.
one.
Yeah.
It's got to go back to your passive lymphatic system.
Okay.
So now we ask a simple question. Would sitting still with a bag of ice wrapped tightly around your ankle mm-hmm. while sticking it up in the air move waste through the passive lymphatic system?
Yeah.
Well, remember what we have to have the squeezing of the muscle yep. contraction. So you've shut the signals off between the muscles and the nerves by making it cold. You're sitting still, so there's no muscle activation. You've compressing the very vessels you're trying to move the waste through. I mean, just think about this. You're trying to move waste down your garbage disposal.
Yeah.
And I say, well, the problem is you have a 1.5-inch pipe under your sink. Let's put an 1/8-inch pipe there instead.
Yeah.
You'd be like, well, that won't work. Right. So why are you compressing it? Remember, yeah. the tourniquet is to prevent a bleed out from the intact body part.
Yeah.
You don't put tourniquets on bodies that you're trying to move waste to the passive lymphatic system.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, they do. So now you say, well, but if I sit still with a bag of ice wrapped tightly around and I stick it in the air, that's going to move the swelling out of my ankle? Well, the answer is, of course it doesn't. It yeah. can't. There's no chance that's going to work. You've yeah. done everything you can do practically to prevent it from moving.
Yeah.
So you say, well, I don't want my ankle to be swollen. And then I'll tell you, then don't do the Rice protocol, because that is completely the opposite of what you need to do. What you need to do is activate the muscles in and around the damaged site and increase circulation, not decrease circulation.
Yeah.
You want the fluid to move, not sit still. You want the clotting factors, the repair and cleanup crew, to get to the damaged site.
Yeah.
They can't get there if you sit still with a bag of ice wrapped tightly around it by sticking it in the air.
Yeah. So what about, say, now somebody might be thinking, okay, I don't want to activate my muscle because it hurts. I shouldn't ice it. I shouldn't compress it. But elevating it might make sense, because would gravity help flush that swelling or lymphatic system kind of out if I elevate it?
No. No, isn't that surprising? The answer was no. It's a passive lymphatic system.
Yeah.
If you had to elevate to move the waste through your passive lymphatic system, then why aren't your feet filled up with fluid right now?
Yep.
They're not elevated, are they?
Nope. They're sitting flat on the ground.
So yeah. And what about anything above your head? Mm-hmm. Do you have to stand on your head to stop it from evacuating? I mean,
yeah.
As soon as you think it through, you go, well, how would that work? Exactly. I'm going to elevate. I'm going to stick it up in the air. Let's just see what sticking up in the air does. Let's say it helped the flow in one direction.
Okay.
Does that mean it's hurting it in the other?
Probably.
So here's your heart trying to pump blood to the damaged site, which is bringing the repair and cleanup crew.
Yeah.
So you elevate the body part because you're so smart, and the repair and cleanup crew are trying to send or trying to get to the damaged site, but you're creating roadblocks by not moving. So there's no muscle activation. There's no blood flow increase. You made it cold, which slowed down the blood flow increase or the blood flow. You compressed it. Yep. Was just about stopped the flow of the repair and cleanup crew getting to the damage site. And then just to make sure nobody gets there, you stick it up in the air. Now, does stick it up in the air affect blood flow to the site? Yes, it slows it down.
Yeah.
So a lot, a little, but it does. I mean, you know, take your hand above your head and try to put a bulb in a light and have trouble. And after about a minute or so, you're going to put your hand down, kind of shake it because there's not enough blood getting to your fingers.
Yeah.
But it hurt it going up, and it likely helped it a little in the venous return.
Yeah.
But remember, the pressure is what drives that. It's a closed system.
Yeah.
You basically stop the pressure by elevating it. It's so wrong, it's almost comical.
Yeah. Once you spell it out, once you think about it, this whole conversation makes sense. Going on to another claim of icing, numbs the pain.
It does. And I liken that to the sympathetic bartender that gives the alcoholic a drink so he can temporarily feel better. Did it work? Maybe.
Yeah.
Did it solve the problem? No. Did it make things worse? Probably. But the alcoholic doesn't hang himself that night. And he was going to. So you say, hey, that's a net gain. He didn't kill himself. So you tell me that we've got a 12-year-old with a dislocated ankle. We're 45 minutes from the hospital. All we have is a bag of ice and a driver. And no one at the site knows how to relocate the ankle. Put it on ice. It makes perfect sense to do it then, because it'll work.
Yep.
And the damage that it will cause, when you put ice on, it delays healing, it increases swelling, and it causes additional damage. But it does relieve pain.
Yep.
And so does giving an alcoholic a drink solve that problem.
Yep.
But now we have a question. How often does that happen?
Yeah, not
very. Would it work? Sure. That first of all, if you gave that young person with the dislocated ankle the bag of ice and you talked to him, you'd calm him down and it would start hurting less. So they'd stop panicking and kicking their foot around and crying.
Yep.
So it would work. Then on top of that, when you get to the hospital, it would be numb.
Yeah.
And it'd be much easier to relocate the ankle if it's not grossly swollen. And the ice will temporarily delay the swelling.
Yeah.
So it makes sense then. So can you use it for pain control? Just be careful what you wish for.
Yeah.
Because you're bringing along with that, you're going to delay healing.
Yep.
Because you're delaying the transportation of the repair and cleanup crew and the evacuation of the waste. Yeah. So you're delaying healing. Now, in that 45 minutes of the hospital, who cares?
Yeah.
Solve the problem, get to the hospital, make the kids stop crying. So I'm 100% for that. There.
Yep.
But for someone who says, well, yeah, but you know, I want to make it numb so I can exercise because I heard exercise is going to be good for me. Well, hold on. Now you shut off the signals that alert you to harmful movement.
Yeah.
You need movement to solve the problem, but those signals alert you to harmful movement so you don't hurt yourself. So no, you don't use it to shut off the signals that alert you to harmful movement and then go do harmful movements.
Yeah. Yeah.
Could you use it to make something not hurt? Well, actually, there are much better ways to make it not hurt. And I'll prove it to you and your audience. Anybody who wants to try this can just do it. If you've ever badly sprained your ankle, and you probably have being a runner, you remember that there was a position that made it hurt twice as much.
Yeah.
Like if you jumped up and down, that made it hurt a lot.
Yeah.
But if you laid down and kind of got your leg in the right position, it made it stop hurting pretty much all the way, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So there are better ways of controlling pain than making it cold and being in the wrong position. Mm-hmm. So find that neutral position that has the least pain. And then there are electronic ways of pain control. You know, people call them TENS machines and things. Okay. So there are ways to control pain electronically that doesn't drag the ice problems along with it. But remember, when you shut off the signals that alert you to harmful movement, you have not solved the problem.
Yep.
You've just shut off the signals that alert you to harmful movement. So here's the problem with that. Let's say you broke your collarbone. And I've been involved in people who have done this. And I give you a bag of ice and I put it on your shoulder area and I make it stop hurting and you fall asleep for 3 hours. And the whole time you're sleeping, you're distracting the fracture site. In other words, you're pulling the fracture site apart because you're in a position that you should have been warned hurts, but you've made it numb. So you can't feel it. Could you find me anywhere in medicine that somebody would recommend that you distract a fresh fracture site for 3 hours while you sleep?
No.
No, of course not. So you see the problem?
Yeah.
Yes, it works, but be careful what you wish for.
Yeah.
Because now what you've done is, and it's the key point, you have shut off the signals that alert you to harmful movement. Mm-hmm. You need movement to solve the problem, but you need the signals to alert you to harmful movement so you don't hurt yourself. So yeah, you'll make it not hurt, but is that what you want or do you want to solve the problem?
Yeah.
So let's just say you say, my ankle hurts so bad. And I look down, it's all swollen and black and blue. And I say, well, how about if we get the swelling out and see how it feels?
Yeah.
And we'll find a neutral position, get the swelling out, and then we'll see how much it hurts. Anybody that I've ever worked with, and it equals thousands of athletes, thousands, maybe tens of thousands. I don't know, but I'll just say thousands.
Yeah.
Thousands of athletes. Once you get the swelling out, most of the pain is gone.
Yeah.
And if you find a neutral position, well, then there's almost no pain. Yeah. I broke my collarbone several years ago. The story's in the book. And when I broke my collarbone, it hurt a lot when I hit and it snapped. Fortunately, I turned my head and I was actually running. And I tripped down in Baltimore, Maryland, running around the harbor area. And nothing was there. I just tripped. And I broke my collarbone and I was lying on the sidewalk. And if you've ever done it, you quickly realize you can't push up off your hands and get up. You have to kind of wiggle to your side because your arm doesn't work.
Okay.
And a woman came running over who was happened to be running down the other side of the street. And she said, I'm calling an ambulance. Don't move. I'm like, oh, no, don't call an ambulance. I'm going to get up. And she said, what's wrong? I said, I broke my collarbone. She said, how do you know? I said, I felt it snap in half and I can't get up. So I know it's broken.
Yeah.
And I got up and she looked at me and she said, really? She said, you should go to the hospital. And I said, no, because I can see my hotel over there. I was staying at the Marriott over by the stadium. Yeah. So I can see my hotel. It's about a mile and a half away. And, you know, I'm just going to go to the hotel and I'll figure it out when I get there. She said, well, I'm not going to let you go by yourself. I said, okay, well, you want to come? And so she ran with me. Now, unfortunately, I never got her name. I never got to thank her. But every time I do a podcast, I say, hey, by the way, if you're the woman who helped me, thank you.
Yeah.
I'd love to know your name. But she ran all the way back with me. But in about the first 10 steps, I went, ah. Oh. She said, what's wrong? I said, it went back into place. Now, once the bone snapped back into place, it felt way better than it did for those first 10 steps. So I run away back to the hotel and I get myself into the hotel, and that night, I had to drive to Philadelphia where my doc was, because I knew a doc there. So I went to go to someone I knew. And I drove up Sunday night, and then Monday morning I went in to see him, or Monday around 1 o'clock, I went in to see him. And when I got there, he said, what do you think's going on? I said, it broke. And he went, well, okay, let's take a look. He took a look. He goes, well, I don't see any swelling. I said, trust me, it's broke. Well, see, I had used a muscle activation device that because I represent a medical grade muscle activation device. I had used it for about 16 hours post-trauma. I had no swelling. I had no pain.
Wow.
He said to me, I figured I was going to have surgery, because for whatever reason, I believed you had to have surgery when you broke your collarbone.
Yeah.
And he said to me, Gary, it's perfectly aligned. There's nothing we need to do. I mean, it's good. You wear a sling and you'll be fine. And I went, okay. So he started writing me a prescription for pain meds and anti-inflammatories. I said, Doc, why would I take an anti-inflammatory? Don't I want my inflammatory response to react to this damage? He's like, well, yeah. I said, okay, well, then I don't like that. And he tried to give me some pain meds. And I'm like, yeah. I don't need those. And he said, no, tonight's going to be a bad night. I said, no, Doc, last night was a bad night. Because last night I thought I was going to have surgery today. So I'm not having a bad night at all right now. Tonight's going to be simple. I don't need pain meds. And he tore the scripts up and threw them away. I broke my collarbone. Never even considered a drug, because I didn't need it. I had no pain because I had the swelling controlled and I found the neutral position.
Yeah.
So at the Saturday, 6 days post-break, I had my arm fully extended above my head.
Wow.
Now, my doc said to me, Gary, just be aware that people our age have to be careful of a frozen shoulder. I said, I'm not on no frozen shoulder. And he goes, I'm just telling you, be careful. I had my arm fully extended above my head, 6 days post-break.
Wow.
Now, why? Because I never had the swelling. I didn't have pain. I found a neutral position and I stayed there. They put me in a sling, by the way, and the sling had me in such a position that it made it hurt.
No.
I'm like, well, that's a stupid position. So yeah. I lowered it down and I caught my thumb on my belt loop.
Yeah.
And it didn't hurt there. So that's how I went around the next couple of days. I didn't wear a sling. I didn't do anything. Now, when I went through security at the airport, he told me, wear the sling so they don't pat you down. I said, okay, that makes sense. I don't want anybody banging my shoulder right now. So
yeah.
So once I got through security, I took the sling off. I never wore it again. Now, why did it hurt? Or why didn't it hurt? Well, A, I didn't make it cold and distracted while I fell asleep for several hours the first night. So I was beginning to heal immediately. My repair and cleanup crew got to the site.
Yep.
I didn't have any swelling.
Yep.
None. There was none. There was some black and blue, but I had no actual swell. Well, that's not fair. There may have been a little swell. There was noticeable palpable swelling.
Yeah. To be fair, you had that, what swelling is, you know, kind of the waste product of inflammation. You had it. You were just getting it away with your TENS unit or your, what was that unit that you were
using? It's a muscle stimulator. It's called an H-wave.
H-wave.
And I was using it to just decongest the area in and around the damaged site, because I knew that if it started to swell, that was going to make it hurt and I would lose function. So I'd have pain and lost function, and I don't want either of those things.
Yeah.
So I just kept it clean.
Yeah.
And as the fluid was coming to the damaged site, I was evacuating the excess.
Yep.
Very simple. And by the way, I've done that through my network of people many, many, many hundreds of times.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So I'm going to have to stop us there. I know the conversation isn't over, but I didn't want to intimidate you with having nearly a 2-hour episode in the queue. So I had to split this into 2 episodes, but there is more great stuff coming next week in part 2, including icing for mental toughness, how to get the right message out there, and real world examples of what Gary has been doing with his athletes that has taken 4 to 6 week injuries and made them 4 to 6 day injuries. So subscribe up if you don't want to miss out. Tell a friend. it may be helping their career. See you next week.